Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Friday at this time, he joins us for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you, Nachum.
I saw someone tweet this, and I don't know where it comes from, and I hope it's not made up, but apparently in the last 24 hours, Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport set a record for number of travelers in a 24-hour period through the airport?
I have not seen that officially reported, but it is possible. Tourism is doing very well. This is perhaps going to be a record year, so it is fully feasible that that is true.
Yeah, I saw the numbers for both 2010 and 2011 so far, and it's absolutely astounding. And I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that on Monday, a massive Nefesh B'Nefesh flight leaves from Kennedy Airport to head to Israel. And I had heard rumors, because we have a couple of folks on the plane who we know, and I had heard rumors about, you know, half the plane being singles, like just an amazing number of youthful, an amazing amount of youthful enthusiasm on that plane. What I did confirm when I saw Avi Levine on a Wednesday night, what I did confirm is that there are 100 soldiers on Monday's flight. Is that unbelievable?
It is unbelievable. Nefesh is doing a great job, and I'm honored to be one of the early members of its board and been involved with it since inception. And I think that they've really done a remarkable job facilitating people being able to go on Aliyah. And that, I think, more and more people, when you look at the economic conditions here, you look at all the other things that people always took for granted here, Israel is looking more and more attractive.
No question about it. All the excuses are falling by the wayside. And I hope everyone understands this. We say, especially people who are not familiar with Nefesh B'Nefesh, we say 100 soldiers. We're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about guys and gals who are touring the U.S. and now are hitching back to Israel on the Nefesh B'Nefesh flight. We're talking about people who are ready to be inducted into the Israeli army, which is simply astounding. Malcolm, is this the end for the regime, for the reign of President Assad in Syria?
Well, I don't think it's the end yet. I think the end will come when we see the demonstrations focusing on Aleppo and particularly Damascus. There were demonstrations in the last 24 hours in some of the suburbs of Damascus, and they moved tanks into three or four areas. They have been focusing on some of the eastern cities, Deir ez-Zor and others, which it took 4 days to take, by the way. And we're seeing more unrest, but I think one of the things that the business community and others who have benefited greatly under the Assad regime, primarily in Aleppo and in Damascus, are looking at is the opposition. Do they see a unified opposition? Do they really have any confidence that they could take over? Or will it result, number one, in their failure to win? Or two, even if they unseat this the current regime, what will follow? Will it be total chaos? Will all their interests be evaporated? Will their business interests and others be impacted? In Aleppo, there was a festival this week which had a 3,000-foot Syrian flag and thousands of people coming to it, and reporters there said it was like living in two different countries, that in some cities people are being massacred in such large numbers, and then in other places you could have a festival of this kind. So I think it's too early to write it off, and again, because he's not going to give up. I think looking at the Mubarak trial pictures reinforces that. He's gotten warnings. As you know, the Turks sent their foreign minister and put down some pretty hard markers, and he essentially first said, well, within 48 hours the violence would stop, and then dismissed it altogether, and I think that that relationship has deteriorated. I think Iran is investing more and looking to others to put money in to help Syria, and they've been demanding that Iraq do more for it, while the Saudis, on the other hand, are telling them to stop, killing has to stop, putting markers on the other side, and the Saudi Arabians, Kuwaitis, Bahrainis, as I indicated last Friday, they would, all withdrew their ambassadors.
Right. But can you win this thing, or can you emerge, you know, somewhat or less unscathed than complete annihilation when the world media is on your case? I mean, the media is not allowing him to do all the things you describe, because the images coming out of Syria are so distinct and are so awful. Is it possible to maintain control or eventually, reestablish control when the media has the hold on you?
Yeah, but the international media doesn't have much impact inside Syria. First of all, they don't get to see it because everything is blocked. Second of all, because the people who are engaged in this are looking at this from an internal perspective. If you look, on the other hand, what the Arab League did, the Arab League wouldn't condemn it. They said no dramatic action. They issued a statement, they said, and they said they still believe in the persuasion to try and end this. Well, as long as that's the case, and we don't see really tough sanctions, the United States is now trying to push some sanctions that would affect the economy, the banking, especially to sanction the largest commercial bank in Syria, and yet even that hasn't happened when we're so many weeks into this rebellion and killing of individuals and people. You know, we also have to think about what the ramifications are for, let's say, the region, for Israel, for others. You know, him remaining in power, he could look for a diversion and heat up the borders. He could retain power in a loose way. He could try to work out some sort of an arrangement, but it will always be then under the pressure, and the people don't forget thousands of deaths, and you have even war crimes charges being investigated against him. But for him, there's no alternative, because he knows that when he falls, he won't even be Mubarak. He'll be killed right away.
Right.
So will many of his relatives be killed. But then the other option is, what happens if you create a Muslim fundamentalist and Sunni radical government, which Turkey would welcome, but think of the dangers for Israel of having that on its border. What does it mean for Lebanon? So there are the options, and there are more, for what kind of a coalition, but the likelihood that you'd get some sort of a liberal regime emerging out of it under the current circumstances, I think, is far-fetched.
How come change sometimes is good, historically speaking, but it seems in this case, with what's happening in the Middle East, there's nowhere that's enjoying positive change. Only bedlam is resulting from all these different changes that are either going on or that are being demanded on the street.
Because this was not what it was portrayed to be. And you know, we've discussed this for weeks in trying to show people what the reality. Let's take Egypt. In Egypt, the military, which was pro-Western, is now saying that the pro-democracy people are spies and saboteurs. They blame the economic problems on foreign infiltration, and they blame U.S. funding. Some have even, of course, blamed Israel. The Sinai, we see, is completely in chaos right now. You saw the huge demonstration of the Salafis. They're making more and more common cause with the larger brotherhood. They started their own political party. They hosted a conference this week of 14 Arab Muslim countries, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Palestinian terrorist groups, and an anti-U.S. resistance group from Iraq in Cairo on the legitimacy of armed resistance and advocacy of that, which is essentially terrorism. And Egypt was going to be the model how they were going to turn Tahrir Square's democratic protest for democracy, when we know behind the scenes there was the Muslim Brotherhood, Iran, and the government itself perhaps in league now with the Muslim Brotherhood, the military, because they want to protect their interests in the long run, and they have vast economic stake in all of this.
I know you don't like predictions, but it sounds like you have a lot more faith in the future of Assad than one would have had in the future of Mubarak.
Well, Mubarak had an army to turn things over to. He has nothing. There's no alternative. There's no unifying national force, and the opposition is too fractured and too divided, I think, to take it over. And for him, and what he told me when I saw him, earlier in the year, was that he knows that if there was ever an overthrow of his regime, the Alawites will be massacred. Many of them have already gone back to the mountains. They are issuing statements, and as one of the editorials this week, I think, in the Jerusalem Post, pointed out about how they're clinging desperately to power. And you know what else they came up with? And this, I think, is fascinating. In 1936, a group of six Alawite notables sent a memo to the French prime minister, who was then Leon Blum, a Jew, and explained why they didn't want to be annexed to a Muslim Syria, this meaning the Alawite areas. Mm-hmm. And they write that the condition of the Jews in Palestine is the strongest and most explicit evidence of the militancy of Islamic issue vis-a-vis those who do not belong to Islam. These good Jews contributed to the Arabs with civilization and peace, scattered gold, established prosperity, etc., etc., and the Muslims declare holy war against them, never hesitated to slaughter their women and children. So here were the Alawite leaders, including Assad's father, Bashar's grandfather, signing this declaration in 1936.
And it couldn't have been a more potent example with what we know was happening to Jews in Palestine in 1936.
After 1929, after 1936, and of course later.
All right, so the instability of the region continues to be the big headline when it comes to the Middle East, and one of the most interesting things to us is to analyze whether the protests in Israel, I'm not talking now about Ramat Shlomo, we'll get to that, I'm talking about the housing crisis protest and the disparity between the wealthy and others protest in Israel, whether this is causing instability as well. Is this starting to get out of hand, or is this going to eventually get under control?
Well, I think the demonstrations have been very much in control. When you have 250,000 people and, you know, a couple of minor arrests, but you have the looting, you have demonstrations all over the country, young people involved, and they've been orderly, and there are reports, of course, of political manipulation of donors from the United States and elsewhere, and they're saying have political objectives. They said they did not have political objectives.
Leftist donors, according to the paper.
Well, yeah, of course, it's not a rightist demonstration, although there are right-wing people. This is not isolated to one sector of this society, and many religious people participated in some of the demonstrations or had their own. When you had the march of the women with the baby carriages, there were many. I know that at the Tel Aviv Kikar Rothschild, the Rothschild Square demonstrations, there is one tent that is Breslover. And in fact, I must say I was very uplifted by the report about Tisha B'Av in this camp, which is, you know, almost overwhelmingly secular people, that they decided they would not allow any music on Tisha B'Av and issued a public statement to that effect and said that they closed their kitchen early and they did have cookies and water available to those who didn't fast, but said that out of respect and out of identification, they would not do anything that violated the spirit of Tisha B'Av and had public readings of Eicha in this camp. Now, remember, these are not religious people doing it, but I thought that it was I found it uplifting and encouraging.
Right. Those from the previous generation will tell you this would not have happened 60 years ago.
Wouldn't have happened 60 years ago, although there was respect always, and more respect in those days for, I think, the religious parties, and the religious parties played a different role.
Well, the friction, the physical friction between the religious and non-religious neighborhoods in those days, I think, was a little rougher.
I'm not sure that the divide was really rougher than it is today. It's an interesting question. I think something that would have to be.
I think
there have been times.
I think some of the old timers would describe life on the socialist kibbutzim as being.
Oh yes, of course they were very anti and hostile. And now today, many of them have synagogues and
exactly
have changed in that regard. Absolutely.
Malcolm is with us. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmn.org. I keep asking you this question, but don't you agree more and more as the weeks go by that if he was not the prime minister, these protests would not be happening?
No, I think that there are. In fact, if anybody of all the prime ministers, anybody who understands economics and who has tried to institute reforms, I think it's Netanyahu.
But the media would not be fueling the effort of those who are marching in the streets if it was a prime minister from a different party.
That's a different question, and I think you're right that people and some of the institutions have tried to, meaning like the media, have tried to politicize this. But you know, the truth is that because of the political array today, the leadership of the different parties, there's no one who's been able to take advantage of this fully. There's nobody who really emerges out of this.
Except a 25-year-old woman. I forgot her name.
Right, and a couple others who have become spokespeople.
Leaf or something? I think it's Leaf.
And remember, it's not one unified leadership.
Right.
And the, you know, I know I met the mayor of Jerusalem yesterday, and he told me that originally they wanted to pitch their tents and everything on the Old City Wall, outside the Old City Wall. And when he spoke to them about why that would not be a good thing, he said they voluntarily all moved to the center of the city. So this is not, you know, comparable to the demonstrations in other places, which some of the media have tried to compare it to. And I think you're right that the media, of course, is blaming Netanyahu, but Netanyahu has tried to institute some of these very reforms and certainly did it. in the past when he was Minister of Finance, and
right.
and he gets it. Most leaders don't understand economics.
Daphne Leaf, by the way, is her name. Daphne Leaf, according to the New York Times. So what do they want? Do they want to, I mean, are we heading back to, you know, more of a socialist Israeli society? There's such an anti-wealthy, anti-corporate feeling now everywhere, including the United States. You know, is that what they're looking for, more division of wealth? I mean, what is the ultimate goal here?
I do think housing is a major problem, but they're also suffering from the increase in the cost of living. And this is a universal problem across the Middle East and across the world. And if you remember, I said that the demonstrations in Tunis, which were presented as for democracy,
right.
were about food prices.
Right, it was about money, right.
And it's about money. Mm-hmm. But income in Egypt, 40% earning $2 a day. How are you going to change this society? How are you going to make progress when and the tourism industry destroyed? Now in Israel, they are far better off than
right.
others, but they have suffered this sharp increase in the price of food. We saw it on the cottage cheese. You see it on other things. But housing is a problem. There is a shortage of housing, and of course, everybody wants to live in the central areas. And there are opportunities in the Galil and the Negev where they should be building, where we need to have Jewish populations. And yet, when Israel tries to put up 93 apartments in Har Homa, you have the whole world coming down on them and making it sound as if they're putting this thing in Mars. These few houses. Steny Hoyer, by the way, today the Democratic. The second Democratic leader in the House came out and said that he's in favor of the building there and said Israel should be entitled to do it. He called it Jerusalem is different than other settlements. I think that was a mistake, but he but his principle, the position that he took.
A guy tries to do a nice thing.
was very important.
BB, more than anybody, should know that, you know, competition, and you mentioned cottage cheese a moment ago. I mean, there are those who are, you know, who are advocating to more of an American model, so to speak, bringing in more, you know, competitive action into these industries. Are his hands tied? Is Israeli corporate society the type? I don't want to use the word, you know, mafia or cartel, but I mean, are his hands tied when it comes to trying to introduce some other type of competitive forces into these industries?
It's very difficult because he has such entrenched interests that go back since Israel's founding, and they have successfully broken some of the socialist tendencies and holds. Everybody knows, whoever has had to deal with Israel, about the bureaucracy, how slow things move, and with the political parties, everyone with their own vested interests, and people looking to the possibility, you know, to elections in a year, so they want to grandstand on the social issues and try to tap into this sentiment, which is much more widespread. I mean, I hear people on the right and people on the left expressing the same views in this regard.
Right.
We're not
right.
seeking political advantage.
Right. That's true. That's true.
And I don't believe it will go back to the socialist system. I do believe that this disparity between the income of the wealthy and the poor and the fact that you have a high-tech society with all the benefits, startup nation, but that it doesn't, you know, come down to many of the people. On the other hand, wealthy people can pay 60% of their income in taxes. That story doesn't get told,
right?
And that they do contribute, and you're now beginning more voluntary, charitable and philanthropic activities by Israelis.
Right. On that note, by the way, excuse me for being philosophical, but on that note, it's almost impossible to believe that a small country, what is it, 7 million people, can possibly sustain the military that it has to sustain. That's number one. You're right, its greatest interest, security of the country and its people. And number two, and the number of poor and the number of those, you know, who are welfare recipients, whatever they call it over there. I mean, it's almost impossible to believe they're able to do it.
I think it's a very important point. It's not philosophical. It's very practical. I think about this often. When you think that Israel, this little country, has to have embassies around the world with staff, and the cost that entails. They have rockets coming in from Gaza, where they have the Israeli Air Force has to fly. Every time they take off and they have to bomb, it costs a fortune. You know, when you have to counter missiles, each shot costs $100,000. The fighting the smugglers that are increasing into Gaza. So that's just one small part of it. They have to be prepared if the Palestinians decide to have demonstrations
right.
in September.
Right.
And they're looking at that. They have a huge university infrastructure.
So how do they do it?
And they give stipends to yeshiva guys, 100,000 more.
Greatest funder of Torah education in the history of the world. So how do they do it?
That's why you have a demonstration. and why have demonstrations? Because the economy is, and a reminder to those in your audience who write and say Israel should give up the aid from the United States, tell America where to go. Think about where those $3 billion, which could be in jeopardy, foreign aid could be in jeopardy in this new world. Israel is the reason you have a foreign aid bill, and I think it is safer now, but that's not a guarantee. Let them think where that $3 billion will come from at a time when Israel is stretched as thin as it is. Saudi Arabia gives $45 billion in subsidies. They just gave 60 or 70 million people a $40 payout to subsidize. They give it periodically. This is, I think, the 12th payment that they've made on the pledge. That was when oil was over $100. With oil below $80, all of a sudden, they're even facing this stretch, and they got $1 billion from India recently in payments, and they have, unfortunately, this new huge oil field that they found, oil and gas field. But still, they're feeling the pinch, too. And that, if they have to remove subsidies from bread, from gas, from other things, wait and see what happens in the streets, even in Iran.
After this conversation, it'll be a good time for an Israel bonds appeal, you know? I'm not kidding. I should do a show on Israel bonds. I'm not kidding. People don't even realize how important.
I'm sure they'd be thrilled.
I'm sure they would. People don't realize how important this is. Unbelievable. The construction that is now being proposed and has been approved. You mentioned Har Haman. Now we hear about Ramat Shlomo as well. Now, don't you realize, Mr. Honlein, that next month there very likely is going to be an effort for a unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state at the United Nations? And don't you know that this action by the Israeli government could, in fact, advance that cause and put Israel in further jeopardy around the world?
Well, one can always argue the timing, but first of all, this is not an announcement that is just made now. This is part of a process of approval for housing that was already approved and has gone through the entire process, which is a lengthy one in Israel. There are 2,000 apartments approved for this area in Har Choma, and they're building 93 units. If you know how much construction is going on in the Palestinian side of East Jerusalem, how many tens of thousands of illegal buildings and construction goes on all the time, yet that, of course, is not an issue. So anything that Israel does at any time is going to be seen as provocative.
Mm-hmm.
You do have a good point, because it'll be exploited, and you have the Europeans and all the others coming down on Israel saying, and the Palestinians saying, this is why we can't have negotiations. You see, they're creating conditions, they're creating facts on the ground. I mean, they don't create facts. Their incitement, which is continuing, honoring terrorists in every form that's possible, all the things that they're doing, that's never an obstacle. But Israel building 93 units, it becomes a major focus. And it's interesting that you can have massacres in countries, you can have all this thing, the world is very reluctant to go public. Israel builds 93 houses in a permitted area, and all of a sudden it becomes the number one crisis in the world. And you're right, we're facing a September that could be very difficult, very controversial. I'm not sure yet that the Palestinians are going to go for the statehood push. As I said all along, I think when they look at the bottom line, and more this week spoke about that.
Yeah, they can't get their act together.
Thank God. By the way, it's interesting to note that Lebanon will be sitting in the presidency of the Security Council in September, for the month of September, and Qatar is going to be the president of the UN General Assembly for the year. So that's going to add an interesting dimension to the conduct of the debates that will inevitably come. The Europeans are working, by the way, on trying to come up with some sort of alternative resolution, some text, while Blair is working on trying to get the negotiations going, as are the Americans. So far, I don't think there's been any real progress, but the people feel there's still possibility, and that will be the easiest thing to preempt it and give Abbas a way to climb down. But they're looking at the day after now, and they're saying to them, what are you going to do? You're going to lose U.S. aid. Members of Congress are repeatedly, Congressman Grimm last night on our show and others, all spoke about it and said, that's it, we're going to cut off the aid. When you have a vote of 406-6 in the House and unanimous in the Senate, that's a pretty strong indication of where they stand on this issue. And the Palestinians, you know, if you are going to just stub it to the United States and say, you know, we're going to disregard this and we're going to go ahead, even after the president, everybody else has said, this is not, we're not going to allow it, we can't have unilateral moves, et cetera, et cetera.
That's PA aid.
Right, the money to the PA,
right,
which anyway should be under scrutiny given the amount that they're giving to terrorists and the family of suicide bombers and to the prisoners in the 5,000 prisoners in Israeli jails, the terrorists who are in Israeli jails, who we receive a monthly stipend from the PA. So, number one, I'm not sure what they're going to do in September. We have to be prepared for every option. We're meeting with all the countries in the United Nations at the local level, meeting here and at their home bases, the foreign ministries, and reaching as many heads of state in a 100-day plan that we developed leading up to September. So no matter what happens, we'll be prepared. I think Durban 3 is already contained, and unless it's manipulated, we're seeing what happens with the declaration. But right now, everybody seems to not want it. To focus on Israel, except of course, you know, you'll have some of the speakers and others who will try to do that. But we think Durban 3 is contained, and major focus is on the unilateral declaration. But as more people come to realize that this is a bad move, and as Palestinians realize that this could be a bad move, as well as the demonstrations that are planned around it, which could easily escalate out of control. I think for all those reasons, many of them want to back off.
You mentioned the foreign aid package and jeopardy in terms of, you know, earlier. Loan guarantees are in that package, or is it a separate deal?
No, loan guarantees are part of the package. That, and I'm not sure, will survive long term. There was some debate about it this time, but the Congress allocated the funds. And this is it's actually money that is that they put out just to guarantee loans, and I think Israel compensates it for it in the end.
So
I don't think it's a real cash outlay, but the but overall, foreign aid has become one of the targets of criticism about the budget
when
it represents a really insignificant part of the U.S. budget.
We know you're well connected to the Jewish community of London. What do you hear about the riots and its proximity to Jewish neighborhoods?
We keep in touch with our counterpart security organizations there, and generally the community has been very careful. They've been told not to walk on certain streets and not to go certain areas. But we know that even last night there were incidents. So far, I know it came into a shopping center next to one of the major Jewish communities. But overall, we do not think that the Jewish communities have been targeted. I think Jewish businesses have suffered.
Is anyone being told not to travel to London? There's no official travel warning from any country, is there?
There isn't, but the Israeli foreign ministry issued a statement warning people not in going to England not to go to certain neighborhoods that have been under fire. Look, the rabbis in the communities are telling people, be careful when you go out.
Go on that. Now, that I understand. I'm always worried.
So people who read that are imposing it on themselves, but the Israelis did, and the British ambassador to Israel came out this morning and warned against it and said, no, there's no danger, you got to come, nothing's going to happen.
I mean, I'm wary of Israel making any statement like that, because we know what it's like to be the target of travel warnings.
Exactly. So it wasn't a travel warning, it was a warning about these neighborhoods to stay away from.
No, that I understand, but it's sort of like when people are demanding that we make some type of public statement about Al Jazeera now being available on certain cable networks. You heard about this?
Yes.
And, you know, anybody who knows the who knows how this show works, for instance, we would never take the risk of trying to censor anybody or encouraging people to do it. Not that I'm for or against that effort, but you know what I mean. So I'm always worried when Israel gets involved in things like that. Could you explain what happened first of all, why is there a need for an apology to Turkey? That's number one. And what went wrong with Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman and his attempt to apologize to Turkey?
That the Turks keep raising the demand. This is becoming an issue that is being exploited. When Turkey, in fact, according to the report, the UN study that was done, the commission that was appointed, and the report has been delayed and delayed because the Turks don't like the report, which essentially lays responsibility on them. It says that the Israelis, some of the soldiers may have used excessive force. I don't know what would have been minor force or less excessive, when some of the soldiers, you know, are still in the hospital a year later.
Right.
They suffered severe brain trauma. They were hit on the head repeatedly by pipes. Nobody talks about it, and nobody, you know, goes and interviews these soldiers, many of whom will be affected for the rest of their lives in what was, quote, a peaceful demonstration. And then that's one of the reasons why Lieberman and others and Bogi Yaalon have said that we can't agree to an apology, first of all, because of the precedent it sets, what it does to the morale of Israeli soldiers and sailors who were involved, who came under assault, and whether this and shifts the onus, and Israel takes upon its responsibility, which could have other ramifications. So Israel has offered to double the compensation. Israel has offered a sort of generic statement, regretting the loss of life, etc. But Erdogan, who is an Islamist, and as people are now coming to realize that the warnings we sounded about what he really represented are more and more manifest, he keeps raising it. He even tied it to, you know, ending the embargo on Gaza, and et cetera, et cetera. There were negotiations that the U.S. had encouraged and helped facilitate, but the bottom line was that they couldn't reach an accord because Erdogan moves the goalposts.
Right. Every single time. You know what was going on 6 years ago this week?
I don't know what was going on last week. I don't remember what.
The expulsion from Gaza was going on post Tisha B'Av 6 years ago this week, and I can't think, analyzing the situation in the last 6 years, of any benefit to that situation.
Well, I think a lot of people, a lot of government officials and others have commented on it. There are still some who try to justify it and say that Israel is better off, but certainly the way it was done, finally, the government has come through with a payoff to the people from Gush Katif and from other areas who were displaced, and hopefully that will enable them to move ahead with their lives in whatever area they chose. But I think you're right. I think history is going to examine this very carefully and may come to various conclusions.
Some people were surprised I didn't mention the murder of Rabbi Abu Chatzera last week when you were on the air. Now, you frequent and often see a Torah personas when you visit Israel. Is this going to change the system of Torah giants meeting with people off the street on a regular basis?
I would hope not, but I think it certainly would give good reason for people to be more concerned. I have always thought about the danger of when... You've ever seen when some of these Gedolim, some of the great rabbis, especially the Kabbalah rabbis, you know, come into places and they're mobbed by all these people,
right,
who grab at them. And I've always been concerned about some of the ramifications that this could have. But, you know, Rebbes are not going to do it. I don't think Rosh Yeshiva are going to do it. I don't think that these rabbis are going to do it. They're not going to isolate themselves from the people. They have the tachan. They have faith that, you know, it happened. It's a almost inexplicable event. It's a great tragedy. He was a great rabbi and a great human being and a great leader. But I don't think that you can succumb to that and isolate them from the people. Maybe there will be greater scrutiny in how letting people in to private meetings with them.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of scrutiny around the rabbis to begin with in terms of who gets entry and how long they have to wait to get that entry. So maybe they should keep security in mind as well. Finally, Malcolm, any update on Jonathan Pollard? We know that his health has been in even more of a precarious situation in the last couple of weeks.
He was taken out for an operation. I understand that he is better. We have the ambassador visited him. There have been other people who have gone to see him, and others who have more and more people have spoken out about the time to release him. I know the new American ambassador in Israel, was asked about it, and there was nothing in his response that I think indicated any imminent change in that status. But before we close, there is another big story this week, a good one, again, about the discovery in that drainage.
Yeah, this is unbelievable.
And again,
the menorah.
Think about this. The week of Tisha, on the eve of Tisha B'Av, when we mourn the destruction of the temples, HaKadosh Baruch Hu again arranges something to wake people up, to tell them this unbelievable story that they found right near where the gold bell was found. They found a sword, an iron sword, 2,000 years old, still in the leather scabbard, in area where the Jews were hiding at the time of the destruction of the temple. This was a Roman soldier's sword who may have either used it to kill the people, or they resisted and he lost his sword in the struggle, whatever. But to find it completely intact, plus other things, pots and coins and stuff, which were obviously left behind by the Jews who had been escaping and either were running or when they were killed, these...
What had the menorah etched into it?
So then, nearby they found also a stone, a rock, in which somebody who obviously had visited the Arabayat, had gone to the base of Mikdash, to the temple, was wowed by what he saw of the menorah, and he etched into the stone. Now, this is 2,000 years ago. He etched into the stone his impression. He only drew five of the seven branches of the menorah, but the more important part is that he drew the base. And you know, there's always been a debate about what the base looked like in the Second Temple. You know, and they used the pictures, depictions from some of the tombstones in Rome of Jews who had escaped from Israel or were taken by force from Israel, and that the ones before the first base, the second base of Mikdash had a lower and a higher pedestal, a different pedestal than those afterwards. But now he depicts a sort of tripodic arrangement of what the base looked like. And he probably drew it and then said, this is too heavy to take back, and he left it there.
Unbelievable.
2,000 years later.
Unbelievable.
A wake-up call. A wake-up call. This is rare. There are, I mean, to see this thing, the five branches become somebody who was clearly overwhelmed by what he saw and wanted to record it or write it or do something. And, I mean, it's amazing. Now, what more of a message this week after Tisha B'Av do we need? So with all the bad news, with all the things that are going on, think of the good news. This is amazing.
It is absolutely incredible. Malcolm, have a great Shabbos. Enjoy Nachamu, and we will speak next week.
I will be at Project Inspire this Shabbos.
Ooh.
To speak, and I look forward to it. And see.
I hope you will inspire and be inspired.
Be inspired, absolutely.
Malcolm Holmlund is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.